This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The height of the election season is also the starting time for a new term of the U.S. Supreme Court. Its justices stay in office longer than any president. And this fall, the court will consider everything from criminal sentences to medical marijuana to the death penalty. Here's NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
This Supreme Court term, like so many others, involves a clash of values on issues that touch millions of American lives. For the first time since 1989, the High Court will take a look at the death penalty for juveniles who are 16 and 17 years old. 15 years ago, a 5-justice majority ruled that there was no national consensus against executing 16 and 17-year-olds because the majority of the death penalty states allowed such executions. But since then, enough states have changed their laws that a majority now draws the execution line at 18. 4 Supreme Court justices have already indicated they think that executing those under the age of 18 is cruel and unusual punishment. The question is whether there is a 5th vote to find the practice unconstitutional. The deciding vote is likely to be cast by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. As Georgetown law professor Peter Rubin observes,
Justice O'Connor wrote 15 years ago that she thought there was no national consensus about executing juvenile offenders, but that, in her words, the day may come when there is. We'll see if she thinks that day has arrived.
Also on the docket is an important property rights case testing whether governments may seize people's homes and businesses for economic development projects. The Constitution allows government to take private property for public use if the property owner is paid just compensation. In this case, the city of New London, Connecticut, following the path cut by many other depressed cities across the country, plans to raise a working-class neighborhood to clear the way for the building of a privately owned riverfront hotel and commercial complex. But can government order the transfer of private property from one group of property owners to another? The homeowners say no, and now the Supreme Court will decide. Also on the docket is a case testing whether the federal government may prosecute seriously ill patients who grow their own marijuana and use it under a doctor's supervision to alleviate pain and nausea. The case comes from California, where the medical use of marijuana is legal. On this opening day of court, however, the justices will hear 2 cases that are expected to have the most profound immediate effect on the way the federal courts operate. Cases that test whether the guidelines used in the federal courts for sentencing convicted criminals are constitutional. Last June, the High Court invalidated a state criminal sentencing scheme because it allowed judges to impose harsher penalties than the statutory maximum based on a judge's finding of facts instead of a jury's. A coalition of the Supreme Court's 2 most conservative and 3 liberal members teamed up to say that a defendant is denied his constitutional right to a jury trial if the relevant facts that increase his sentence are found by a judge, not a jury. While officials in most state systems said they could live with that decision, it provoked a chaotic reaction in the federal courts, where a system in effect since 1984 requires judges to make findings about the character and conduct of convicted criminals and to impose additional jail time based on those judicial findings. Thus, the court's ruling last June threw a major monkey wrench into the way things are done in the federal system. And within weeks, dozens of courts around the country were delivering contradictory decisions on whether the federal guidelines are constitutional. The Justice Department rushed to the Supreme Court begging for a resolution of the issue. And in August, the High Court expedited 2 cases, which it will hear today. As the ACLU's Stephen Shapiro observes,
it is hard to remember any case in recent years that has so profoundly affected the day-to-day operation of the federal criminal justice system.
In one of the cases before the court today, a Wisconsin man named Freddie Booker was convicted of selling 8 ounces of crack cocaine and of possession with intent to distribute. Under the sentencing guidelines, given his previous drug record, the maximum sentence Booker would have faced for these crimes would have been 22 years in prison. But after a sentencing hearing, the judge sentenced him to 30 years because the judge concluded that Booker had in fact sold more drugs prior to his arrest and that he had lied on the witness stand. The second case took place in Maine and involved the conviction of a man named Duncan Fanfan on 1 count of conspiracy to distribute a pound of cocaine. At the sentencing hearing, prosecutors, as is often the practice, sought to increase his sentence because they contended he was guilty of other crimes and had been a ringleader in the conspiracy. Under the sentencing guidelines, a judge would only need to make a finding on these allegations by a preponderance of the evidence. in order to increase the penalty, and all kinds of evidence that would not be permissible at trial is allowed at a sentencing hearing. But the trial judge said he was forbidden to do that under the Supreme Court's decision last June, and he sentenced Fan Fan based only on the crime for which he was convicted by the jury, in short, 6 years in prison instead of 15. Tom Goldstein of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers articulates the principle that he says renders the current sentencing system unconstitutional.
The Constitution says that if the government is going to put you in jail, it has to prove the facts beyond a reasonable doubt, and it has to prove them to a jury. The current federal sentencing system, however, is that the judge decides the facts that determine how long you go to jail, and he decides them by a preponderance of the evidence.
Defense lawyers aren't the only ones with doubts about the sentencing guidelines. Here's Ted Olson, who served as the government's chief advocate in the Supreme Court for the first 4 years of the Bush administration.
It has always bothered me as an individual, not as a department official or anything else, that you can wind up with twice the length of a sentence because of facts that weren't put before the jury.
Indeed, there have been many cases in which an individual is acquitted of some charges and then has additional jail time added onto his sentence based on those very same charges. The chairman of the U.S. Sentencing Commission, Judge Ricardo Hinojosa, defends the current system, noting that it was enacted to regularize the system, to get rid of huge disparities in sentences, and to ensure that improper characteristics such as race are not factors in calculating sentences. And he contends that all the factors that judges now consider have always been considered.
In a trial before the guideline system was in effect, if a defendant took the stand and the judge felt the defendant had not told the truth, or that somebody was a ringleader, of course you would treat that person very differently than someone who was a minor or a minimal player.
More importantly, as a legal matter, he contends penalties specified under the sentencing guidelines are not statutes, since the guidelines were written by a quasi-judicial commission that includes three judges. Thus, the argument is, if a judge adds time onto a sentence under the guidelines framework, the judge is not exceeding the maximum statutory sentence. The Justice Department's Deborah Rhodes puts it this way.
Our position is that the guidelines are not statutory maximums.
In short, they were not enacted by Congress. But former Solicitor General Ted Olson thinks that argument is a hard sell, since Congress has mandated that the guidelines are binding on judges.
The problem is that the sentencing guidelines have the force of law.
In a recent panel discussion, that sentiment was echoed by Federal Judge Paul Friedman, who observed that almost all the judicial discretion that was built into the guideline system when it was originally enacted has been eliminated by Congress.
Congress has superimposed its views on the guidelines. They've directed the Sentencing Commission to do certain things.
The second question posed by today's sentencing cases is, if a judge can't exceed the guideline range without a jury finding, do the guidelines still exist at all? The Justice Department says the guidelines are worthless without judicial fact-finding in sentencing, and argues that the whole system would then be invalid. But defense lawyers contend that is throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Freddie Booker's lawyer, Christopher Kelly, points to Booker's case as an example of how the system could still work.
If the government thought that Mr. Booker committed extra drug crimes, all they had to do was charge him with those extra drug crimes, and there's nothing unusual about a jury deciding whether somebody committed extra crimes.
A decision in the sentencing cases is expected later in the court term. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.